I want to encourage you this morning to turn in your Bibles to Hebrews chapter 11. If you're visiting with us or you haven't been here in a while at East Boonville Baptist Church, we've been in Hebrews chapter 11 several weeks now as we look at specific men and specific women of whom God called and said, these are the Hall of Fame. There are 19 individuals that are listed in the book of Hebrews chapter 11. If you make it into Hebrews chapter 11, you did something right. We've looked at Abel and how he was a picture of us, to us, of what true worship is. We looked at Enoch and we saw what it meant to truly walk with God. Last week we looked at Noah and we saw what it meant to heed the warnings of God and to prepare ahead of time for judgment comes when we think not. And today we look at Abraham, a man who had a special calling upon his life. As we're going to see in just a moment, every one of us who are the children of God have a call upon our lives. But so many times that calling that we think we have upon our life may not be exactly what we desire, or we may desire something that God has not called us to do. Case in point, there was a man at the turn of the last century by the name of G.W. McCluskey. G.W. McCluskey was a married individual. He had two young daughters and they had a revival that came to their church, lasted a week or two. And through the course of that revival, he had an incredible intimate experience with Jesus Christ. He'd been saved some years, but for lack of better terms, it went up a level. At the conclusion of that revival, he was compelled and he was convinced in his mind that God had called him into the ministry. He was convinced that God had called him to preach. That's what his life's calling on his life was. He was going to leave his job and that's what he was going to do. As he began to search in prayer and he began to pray and to talk to the Lord and to other people, one of the things he realized was this: what he wanted to do is not what God had actually called him to do. God made it very clear to him that he had not called him to be a pastor. He had not called him to be a preacher. But oh, he wanted to so bad. In his despair one morning in his prayer time, he finally got frustrated. He said, okay, God, fine. If you haven't called me to be a pastor, then I pray that I will be the kind of dad and the kind of influence on my two daughters that when they grow up and they fall in love, the life that they will live, they will marry pastors. As he set forth his new calling in life, everything in his life was arranged under that goal, that I am called to be the dad or the father of future pastors' wives. His girls grew up, they became a little bit older, they fell in love, and guess what? They married pastors. G.W. McCluskey did not stop there. He continued to pray that he would be the grandfather of pastors and those who married pastors. He couldn't go into the ministry himself. God had not called him, but God had called him to be the father of those who did. His two daughters produced five grandchildren. Of his five grandchildren, every single one of them either went into the pastorate if they were male, or they married pastors if they were female. So he had two daughters and five grandchildren, all of them somehow directly in the ministry of the pastorate, either pastoring themselves or married to one who was. G.W. McCluskey didn't stop. Upon his death, he was continuing to pray for his grandchildren and his great grandchildren. His five grandchildren produced 12 great grandchildren, and he continued to pray that he would be the type of great grandfather that all of his great grandchildren would either grow up to be ministers or would marry ministers. He had 12 of those great grandchildren, and 11 of them followed in their great grandfather's desires for their life. 11 of his great grandchildren either became pastors or married pastors. But there was one black sheep. There was one young man that as he grew up did not feel that God's call on his life was to be in the pastorate. Now, can you imagine the pressure under this young man? He's got 11 fellow great-grandchildren. He's got five aunts and uncles and dads and all these people. And then he's got those two matriarchs up above. Can you imagine what Thanksgiving would have been like? Everybody's a preacher but you. You know, he's the black sheep of the family. I would guess he would be the one that when it came to Christmas or Thanksgiving, he was probably the one person they did not ask to say the blessing. But I'm going to tell you what. Oh, to be that 12th grandchild, great-grandchild of G.W. McCluskey. I'm going to tell you something. You have fathered well if the only black sheep in your family that does not go into the ministry is named James Dobson. I think we all know who he is. Can you imagine the man who's become the father of families in the United States of America, who's maybe done more to promote the cause of Christianity in the family network? He was the only individual of his entire lineage that did not directly follow his great-grandfather's desire for his life. this morning, I don't find it ironic at all that we look at the life of Abraham. And much like G.W. McCluskey, though God worked great things through Abraham, it would be his descendants that would actually be utilized and do more than he himself. Father Abraham, in Hebrews chapter 11, beginning in verse 8, it says, "By faith, Abraham, when he was called to go into a place which he should, after he received an inheritance, obeyed, and he went out, not knowing whether he went. By faith, he sojourned in the land of promise, as in a strange country, dwelling in tabernacles with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. For he looked for a city which has foundations, whose builder and maker is God." The story of Abraham, some roughly about 2,100 B.C., goes a little something like this. Abraham and his wife Sarah at the time were living in a place that we know of called Ur of the Chaldees, just north of what we know as modern day Iraq. He was living out there. He was living some 200 years after what we know as the whole Tower of Babel incident. He's out there and God comes to him and calls him and says, "My desire for you, my calling on your life is to go to a land you know not of and to dwell in a place you've never seen before." There was a calling on his life. Verse 8 says this, when he was called. If today you are a child of God, you may be male, you may be female, doesn't matter. If you are a child of God, there is a calling of God on your life. You say, "Well, God hadn't called me to go to a foreign land like Abraham." That's no less of a calling. Your calling may be to be a teacher. Your calling may be to be a mom. Your calling may be to be a dental hygienist. It doesn't matter. Because the point of the matter is this, that when God calls you to do something, he expects our obedience. Sometimes it involves a land we know not of. Sometimes it involves questions we cannot answer. But the first thing I want to deal with this morning is this. What is a calling? We talk about obedience a lot. We talk about discipleship a lot. But how do we talk about what is our calling in life? G.W. McCluskey found some 100 years ago that God had a calling on his life to raise children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren to go into the ministry. But let me state this. I would state that over 95% of Christian people have no clue what their calling is. They have no clue why they're here. They have no idea why God or what God's purpose is for their life. We just meander aimlessly around. Abraham was called. What is an aspect of a God calling on someone's life? For the sake of definition, the word calling means this, a summons to a particular activity. And so the question becomes this, what has God called you to be about? What has he called you to do? Where has he called you to serve? You say, "Well, I don't know." Then we need to start listening. Now, let me give you some warning signs before we get into the detail of Abraham's calling. And is this, sometimes we best know what something is by figuring out what it is not. What is a calling not? Let me tell you three things that a calling does not consist of. It's not your conversion. In other words, at the point in your life where you say, "I've realized my sin, I've called upon Jesus to forgive me and save me. That's my calling in life." No, no, no. He calls you to be saved. But once you've been called, then you have a calling. Notice the difference there? You are called and then you have a calling. Your calling is not your conversion. Okay? Let me state this. Your calling or anybody's calling is not the Great Commission. The Great Commission is for all of us, no matter what our calling is. The Great Commission is for those who've been called to work with children. The Great Commission is those who've been called to work with senior adults. The Great Commission is for those who've been called to erect buildings. There's none of us that get out of the Great Commission. Our calling is completely different, but yet indirectly related. And I think this is important to note. Your calling is not contagious. In other words, if you go and hang around people who have an idea of what God's doing in their life, it will not necessarily rub off on you. You think, "Well, if I get next to this person, I just spend more time with them. They know what they're supposed to be doing with their life. Maybe I'll just rub off or it'll rub off on me." The vice versa is true, too. Just because you may know what your calling in life is, you cannot make someone else's calling yours. God has a specific calling for each of our lives, and every one of them is like a thumbprint. They're unique to you. Now, it may be in the same area. It may be in the same genre, but it is your specific thumbprint. There are hundreds of thousands of pastors in America. And you may be thinking, "Lord, that we're not all alike. And none of them are all like me." We all have the general calling on our lives, but yet at the same time, each one of us is individually different. So what is a calling? First off is this. It's specific. God is not into rovers. Y'all know what a rover is? Those of you who play softball? That's one of the things I love about softball that's different than baseball, particularly in the softball leagues I've played. Typically, when you field a baseball team, you put nine guys out there. But in softball, you get this 10th person. You can put the 10th person anywhere you want to. You can put them in the infield. You can put them in the outfield. You can put them right at the pitcher's mound. It doesn't matter. They can just go anywhere, anytime. And generally speaking, those who play Rover are pretty good at most everything. But one of the problems about Rovers is this. Once you rove a lot, it's hard to play a particular position. See, God has called us to a specific task. He's called us to a specific purpose. He's called you for a specific ministry. You have a position in His ministry. The second thing about your calling is this. It's not just specific, it's supernatural. You can take every test there is in the world and go, what can I figure out what God's call in my life is? You've got to do what G.W. McCluskey did. You've got to do what Abraham did. You've got to open your ears and listen. You can take all the tests in the world. Now, I'm going to be honest with you this morning. There are these tests out there, these spiritual gifts tests. Y'all seen them. You can either get them on paper or you can get them on the internet. And supposedly, by answering a series of questions, you can find out what your giftedness is as far as different aspects of ministry within a local church. I'm not against those tests, but let me tell you what I found out about them. Oftentimes, they tend to put round pegs in square holes. Because oftentimes you're listening to the way something is constructed rather than listening to what God has told you specifically. God may specifically call you to be about something that you don't answer on that test. Let me tell you this. What I do for a profession, what I do for a living, is not what was discovered on my vocational aptitude test when I was in high school. And I think all of us experience that. Those of you who have been through or experiencing college right now, the average college student changes their major three times. And that doesn't include undecided. So you can make it four if you want to. You change your major three different times because you go through a process. What am I called, or what is my agenda? What have I been called to do? But the sad reality of the matter is this. Did you know that Webster's Dictionary defined a word last year specifically for college students who get a degree and come back home because they don't have a clue what they're supposed to do? Why? We may get educated. We may get trained. We may fill out all the forms. But the difference is we have not listened to God and said, what am I called to do? Because when you hear what you're called to do and you do it, God blesses you even if it's not what you expect it to be. Do you think Abraham woke up one morning and go, man, I want to go live in the middle of the desert where nobody else is. I don't know where my food is. I don't know where my shelter is. I don't know if there's any enemies, but I cannot wait to go out in the middle of nowhere. No. God just pointed west and said, go. And he went. Every one of us who's a child of God has a calling. The calling on your life, though, possesses this. It possesses a promise. Look with me in verse 8. It says, by faith, Abraham, when he was called to go out into a place which he should after receive for an inheritance, he obeyed and he went out, not knowing whither he went. He was promised an inheritance. In other words, God said this, if you will go, you will receive. By the sheer definition of inheritance, two things have got to take place. By means of an inheritance, those who inherit something typically receive more than the one giving the inheritance. Now, this may sound frivolous, but it's true. In the financial world, I am worth a lot more dead than alive. I am. I've got life insurance policies. And if something unfortunately were to occur to me physically and I were to die, my children will receive a lot more financial compensation than if I remain alive. The inheritance financially is greater to my descendants than it is to me personally. And the same thing took place in Abraham. The inheritance of his great-grandchildren, the 12 tribes of Israel, was greater than he alone. But here's the hard thing about an inheritance. You ready? In order to receive an inheritance, you got to die. The only way to receive an inheritance is for somebody to die. That's exactly what took place in Abraham's life. He had to die to self. He had to die to his own personal dreams. He had to die to whatever he thought he might want to do with his life and said, okay, God, I die to me. I'll do whatever you want me to do. You look through all the great men and women of the Bible, whether it's Isaiah, whether it's Abraham, whether it's Sarah, whoever, you fill in the blank. And it doesn't just have to be the 19 ones listed in Hebrews 11. Every single one of them became great for God because they died to self. They said, it doesn't matter what I want to do. It's what has God called me to do. Now, interesting here, it says that God calls him to go to a place. Not only does he call him to go to a place, he calls that there are going to be specific people that are going to receive this inheritance, Isaac and Jacob. I believe that God's calling on any of our lives involves those two elements. It involves a place and it involves people. God has called you, he has called me to serve in a particular place. Now let me give you some warning. The place he's called you to serve may not be the place you want to serve. Now, I'm going to be honest with you. We've lived here about almost 8 months. Let me tell you some things I've heard from some people's mouths. I'll never move out of the county. Ooh, that's a tough prayer, folks. I've heard some people say, I'll never leave my job. Folks, that's a dangerous thing to say to God. To go to God and say, you know what? I want to do anything you want me to do as long as it's within this geographical location, as long as it's at that specific location. Oh, no, 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 no. See, God gets to pick the place. And God gets to place you. See, one of the hardest things in the world to do is say, all right, God, wherever it is, I'm just here. It may take you out of your comfort zone. It may take you out of an element that you desire. It may make you uncomfortable. But God says, I will bless you much like he did Abraham. So not does it only involve a place, it involves people. The inheritance of Abraham involved Isaac and Jacob. This is one of the ways you can know that you're fulfilling God's call in your life is this. Are there people and individuals being impacted with the gospel? If people aren't being impacted, you're not walking with God because God is interested in people. He blessed the land that Abraham went to, but more than that, he blessed the lineage that would be raised in that. You notice all throughout the Old Testament, they never said, oh, we worship the God who gave Abraham that land. Oh, no, no, no. They said, we worship the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. A specific place. Now, I want to show you how Abraham stepped out on faith here. Turn to Revelation chapter 21. Everybody likes going to Revelation. In Revelation chapter 21, we just read in Hebrews 11 that it said, Abraham went looking for a city. Verse 10 specifically says, a city that was built and made by God. Now, before we read this passage in Revelation 21, let me give you a reminder of the history lesson that Abraham would have had. You know, we live in the United States of America. Most of us have a general concept of the events that have taken place in our country 200, 250 years ago. We know the things about the Revolution. We understand the environment that took place there. As we come up on July 4th, we understand about the Boston Tea Party and some of these other events that took place. We may not know all the specifics, but we have an understanding. See, when Abraham was called out to do something for the Lord, there were two cities that would have been in his mind. The only two cities that we hear about in the Bible up to this point are these. The one that Cain built. Now, that wasn't a good situation, was it? Remember the whole thing where Cain kills Abel? God sends him out to the land of Nod east of Eden, and he places a mark upon him. The first thing Cain does is he builds a city. You go through Genesis 4 and you will find out that was not a good situation. Cain builds a city. The other city that Abraham would have been familiar with would have been what we know as Babel, the place in Genesis 11, where all the humanity come together. They decide to build a city that has a tower in it to reach to God. Basically, they want to say, God, we're in charge. You're not. Abraham, in verse 10 of Hebrews 11, says he went to look for a city built by God, made by God. Cain's city was built by man. Babel city was made by man. He's going into the middle of the desert. What city does he expect to find? I mean, think about it. When you go out in the middle of the desert where no one lives, how do you expect to find any city, much less one that has been built and made by God? See, we're about to see how much Abraham had been listening to God. If you'll study the prophecies of the Old Testament, particularly into the book of Revelation, one of the things that you will see is this. For all of eternity, there is a city made and built by God. It is a city entitled the New Jerusalem. In fact, through the book of Revelation, it says that this city one day will be brought out of heaven and will touch earth, the new earth, that is. Those of you studying in Ezekiel in our Sunday school lessons hopefully have alluded to this in some respect. But the city is called from God. It's built. It's made from God. It descends to the earth. Revelation 21. In verse 12, names something very specific about this city. It had a wall great and high. It had 12 gates, and at the gates 12 angels, and whose names written thereon, which are the names of the 12 tribes of the children of Israel. Who was Israel? Jacob. In other words, in Hebrews 11, when it talks about the calling of God on Abraham's life, by the way, when he received his calling, he didn't have Isaac yet. We'll talk about that in just a moment. He goes to a land he knew not of. He goes out to a strange country, and he looks for a city that will have as its foundations the names of his great-grandchildren. And he's never even had a son yet. See, when you have the calling of God on your life, you will do what the world says is crazy. You will do what the world says is ridiculous. But I'm here to tell you that's exactly the kind of people that God is looking for. The reason you've only got 19 names in Hebrews 11 is very few of us can get out of man's box and get into God's order, so to speak, and say, all right, God, I'll go wherever you want me to go, do whatever you want me to do, even though I don't understand it, I cannot explain it, I'm willing to do it. Back in Hebrews 11, in verse 10, it says that the city had foundations. Now, I've only owned two houses in my life. I grew up in another one, but every house I've been in has had a foundation, not many foundations. See, the Bible's very specific. Abraham understood what was going on. God said, I will bless you through a lineage you have yet to see. There was a calling on his life. There was a promise of an inheritance. Here's the third thing that's so crucial this morning, God, particularly on Father's Day. He obeyed. He didn't just say, all right, God, glad to get the movie. Glad to get the information. No, he actually had to pack his bags. He had to go to his wife and say, guess what, honey, I got something for you. What's that? We're going to move. Oh, are we upgrading the house? Well, not really. In fact, we're going to go where they don't have any houses. Okay, are we going to start our new subdivision? No, we're going to the middle of the desert. Where are we going to get water? Don't know. Where are we going to get food? Don't know. What are we going to do with our money? Don't know. But we're going. She said, okay. And they went. He simply obeyed. Verse 8 of Hebrews chapter 11. It says, he went out into a place which should after he receive an inheritance. He obeyed. He went out not knowing where he went. Folks, that is the definition of God-called faith right there. Going somewhere that you know not of. Doesn't mean he was completely ignorant. God had told him, but he listened to God's voice even when it was drowned out among everything else. Now, I know what some of you Bible scholars are thinking. Some of you that have been in Sunday school your whole life and been in church for decades. I know what some of you are thinking. If God came to me in the middle of the night, verbally, told me to look at the stars and said, Abraham, do you see the number of the stars out there? I will make your descendants as numerous as those. If God came to me that clear, if God pointed out the stars to me, I wouldn't have trouble with it. The problem is this. We need to go back and look at the chronology. The calling of Abraham is between Genesis chapter 12 and Genesis chapter 15. It culminates in Genesis chapter 22, which we'll address next week. But in Genesis 12, of which Romans chapter 4 verse 3 says, when God called Abraham and he believed God, it was attributed to him as righteousness. When he was called in Genesis 12, the stars weren't up in the sky yet. I mean, they were up there, but God hadn't pointed to them. He simply came to him and said, Abraham, are you willing to go wherever I tell you to go? Are you willing to go to a country you know not of? And Abraham said, I am willing. And he got up and he left. Here's the significance of that. As soon as he got to the desert, something happened. It's called a famine. He got to the desert and the food he was expecting was not there. The water that he was expecting was not there. The blessings he thought he would find when he got there were not there. In fact, he had to go down into the land of Egypt just to survive. When he showed up on his calling, it didn't look anything like he expected it to look like. But it got worse. Then he had that whole scenario with Sarah, his wife, and the Egyptian Pharaoh. Many of y'all are familiar with that situation. Not only did he go to a land that didn't present immediately what he thought it would, when he got there, he had a whole relationship issue with his wife because the Pharaohs wanted her and he lied about her and all these other kind of things. But it even got worse. Soon after that, there was an incident with his nephew by the name of Lot. We know Lot. He came to Lot and he said, okay, buddy, here's the deal. Our servants are fighting. We've got too many cows. We're out here in the middle of the desert. It's a big place, but we need to go our separate ways. And Lot said, okay, that's fine, Abraham, but I'm going to the land east where it's lush and it's plush. And he went to a place that we know now as Sodom and Gomorrah. But when he goes to this place that God promised him, he got there and it didn't look like what he expected it to look like. The relationship with his wife and that whole scenario got a little strained. And his nephew, who he trusted with all of his finances, up and took off and left the ranch, for a lack of better terms. Then, in chapter 15, God says, "All right, Abraham, I want you to look up in the sky. Do you see some stars up there? Because more numerous than the stars will be your descendants." See, that is the obedience of Abraham. He continued to trudge through even though he couldn't see the light of day. He couldn't see the bright spot. He could not see the light at the end of the tunnel. And I can only imagine the conversations he and his wife had at night. They can't eat. There's a famine in the land. There's been the whole incident with the Pharaohs. Lot's taken off. And I promise you, this conversation took place. Are you sure this is what God wants for us? I'm going to tell you, one of the sure signs and telltale symbols that you are walking with God is when you pray at night and you go, "God, are you sure this is what you want?" Because oftentimes we say, "God, this is what I want." It's usually it's what we want, and we're just putting God's name to it. "God, is this really what you want?" He goes into a foreign land. He goes into a strange country. But notice what it says in verse 10. He looked for a city which we've addressed with foundations, whose builder and maker is God. The calling upon his life, what God had called him to do, even though there were heartaches, even though it didn't look like what he expected to look like, he kept reminding himself, he was assured that God had ordained this, that God had infused this, and that God was its foundation. Every calling of God upon any person's life is going to have a rock solid foundation. Remember, Jesus told a parable about a man who built a house. Actually, two men, one built on the sand and one built on the rock. And he said, in the process of building, both men said, "Well, what's the big deal here? Both our houses look good." And Jesus said, "Oh, but when the waters come, he who built on the sand will be washed away. He who built on the rock shall stay sturdy." I know I've said this before, but it's worth repeating, that a Christian is a lot like a tea bag. You don't know what they're made out of until you get them in the hot water. And oftentimes I've seen people say, "Well, this is God's calling on my life," and it gets a little rough and they just take off. "This is what God's called me to do, and it doesn't work out exactly how you had it planned." You say, "Well, maybe that's not it." If God has called you to do something, whatever that may be, whatever the obstacles may be in your way, stand firm to the foundation if that's what he's called you to do. By the way, when Abraham was called out, he was 75 years of age. Isaac wasn't born until he was 99. 24 years of waiting until the fulfillment of the promise. The foundation must be solid. The foundation must be built by God, and it must be made by God. You know, it's been said that the safest place in the world is right in the center of God's will. That's exactly where Abraham was. That's exactly where you need to be. I recognize that today is Father's Day. We're looking at Father Abraham. We've seen a modern day model in G.W. McCluskey. But I want to give all you guys and all you ladies who are important to these guys a suggested reading material. It's a book entitled Halftime. It's written by a guy named Bob Buford. And what it does is it takes the concepts and the idea of us as men, and it puts life in the perspective of something that we understand and can relate to, a football game or a basketball game or something that possesses a halftime. And the point of the book is simply this. In a physical match such as football or basketball, you play the first half. When you're done playing the first half, there is a point where you have to come into the locker room and you have to regroup. You have to come and say, "Well, this is what we were doing right. This is what we were doing wrong. Let's adjust this and let's adjust that." In this book, he says that every individual, male or female, even though it's written primarily to men, he says that every one of us experiences a halftime in our life. There is a point in our life where the way we've been doing things, we slow down enough to hear God and he radically alters the game plan. When Abraham was in the Ur of the Chaldees, he did not have children yet. He had a halftime experience. God came to him in the locker room and said, "Guess what, Abraham, we're going to change the game you've been playing. You're not going to play in the Ur of Chaldees. You're going to go play down in the desert." He said, "Okay, I can do that." But in the book Halftime, as he's describing this event, what he basically says is every one of us goes through this experience. The problem is this: do we respond appropriately? The subtitle to the book is this: the search for significance over success. Now think about it. As we go through school, we play sports, we have academic honors, we're involved in drama, or we're involved in the band, or whatever it is. Typically, we as human beings are wired to succeed. I have yet to meet an individual who won the band state competition or a football championship or a baseball championship, hold up the trophy and go, "Well, I was just in it for the music." No, you wanted to win. How many guys win the Super Bowl? Hold up the trophy and go, "Man, I just enjoy playing the game. Thanks, I appreciate it. You can keep the trophy." No. We all have a desire to succeed. It may be our job as we get older. It may be schooling, whatever it is. There is a natural instinct for us. We want to succeed. Success may mean more money in our book. Success may mean more power. Success may mean more things. Typically in America, success has been measured by stuff. By the way, I know some of you have seen the bumper sticker, "He who dies with the most toys still dies." That's a true statement. So if the definition of success for you is stuff, when you die, you won't have any of that stuff anymore. But here's the point of his book. He says there has to come a point in a person's life where they have to transfer from searching for success and have to start transferring to searching for significance. What is it that you're doing in your life that makes an impact on people? What is it in your life that makes an impact on the future? What is it in your life that makes an impact on those coming behind you? You know what the secular world has called this? The midlife crisis. The secular world calls it the midlife crisis. You come to a point where you're tired of your job, you're tired of your family, you're tired of this, you go out, you buy a red sports car, you do this, this, that, and you completely change everything. The only problem is this: rather than being about significance, you've become about success. And Bob uses the model of Abraham. Here's a man who had a lot of success. By the way, when you read the story of Abraham in Genesis, he had a lot of stuff. He had a lot of camels, he had a lot of money, he had a lot of stuff in his life. He had a lot of success, but when God called him to go to the desert, he changed from success to significance. Folks, I'm going to be honest with you this morning. You'll never get it until you understand there's a difference between success and significance. You'll never grasp God's call in your life till you realize it's not about you succeeding. It's not about a notch on your belt. It's about significance and making an eternal impact. But the part of his book that most got me was the very beginning when he said this. He said, most people, when they read this book, will think this is an event that takes place when you're empty nested. This is an event that takes place as you grow older, when you realize and you look back on your life. Here's what he said. He said, here's the important part about the book. He said, you need to experience this at as young an age as possible. He said, young men and young women in high school and in college need to experience halftime. You need to experience, before you go out for 30 years down the wrong road, you need to come to an understanding that life is about significance and walking with God, not about success in the material realm, however you define that. Abraham is the perfect example of a man who said it's not about success, it's about significance. G.W. McCluskey came to a point in his life, he said it's not about success, it's about significance. Let me ask you a question. Has there been a point in your life where you've said it's about significance? Let me give you a hint how you know. You understand that it's about significance when it's no longer about you. If you think it's about you, you've missed the boat. If you think the Christian life is about you, if you think East Boonville Baptist Church is about you, you've missed the boat. Because those who are after success think it is about them. Those who are after significance thinks it's about others. See, if Abraham had done what Abraham probably wanted to do, he'd have stayed right where he was. Nice and comfy. But he understood that his inheritance was people. He understood that there was a calling of Isaac. There was a calling of Jacob. There would be the 12 tribes. One of his name would be Judah, of which the Messiah, Jesus Christ, would descend from. He understood that and said, this isn't about me. This is about the Messiah. So he goes to a land he knows not of. He goes to a strange country. And by his obedience, the lineage of the Messiah came from. Folks, there is no limit to what God can do in our lives if our lives are dedicated to Him. I don't know where your search has led you today, but let me inform you of this. Until you've been called, you do not have a calling. Some of you may think, well, I want to know my plan. I want to know my purpose. I want to know why am I here. Until you have a relationship with Jesus, there is no calling. There's just a call. God calls you to be saved, and then He places a calling on your life. If you've never been called, if you've never responded, you need to do that this morning. Maybe you did that some time ago. Well, you need to understand your calling. You say, God, what have I been called to do? God's desire this morning is this, for you to get on His page and get off yours. Let's pray.